Hello, I'm Eric Ripert, chef owner of Le Bernardin in New York City and the host of the TV series Avec Eric on PBS. When I cook, I like to combine flavors, ingredients and texture to create harmony. And when I eat, I like for the wine to complement the food and for the food to elevate the wine. Welcome to Perfect Pairings. Today the subject is acidity.
Virginity?
Acidity.
Oh.
And many times in food, we have the tendency to add a lot of acidity into the dish. For instance, lemon juice on fish sometimes. I remember when I was in California, in Hog Island, we did what they call the hog wash with the oysters. And it was almost like a ceviche. And today we have prepared a more traditional ceviche in Le Bernardin way. It's a fluke, which is marinated with a lot of lime juice and lemon juice.
Yeah, it looks great, chef.
So what did you bring?
Well, chef, listen, I knew you were really into fruit-forward wines, so I brought a classic from California. This is from Boone's Farm Estates. This is the Sun Peach Peak Private Reserve.
On the nose, it's pretty pleasant.
Yeah, on the nose, it is pleasant. Smells like a peach cobbler-scented candle. But wait until you get this bad boy swishing around that French mouth of yours, man.
The fruit is very powerful.
Powerful, yes. That is one way of putting it, chef. You can drink the shit out of this stuff, too. I mean, it's great in a glass, tumbler, or just in a paper bag. Very versatile wine.
I would call this wine a fairly delicate wine.
Dude, seriously?
Therefore, the challenge is not to destroy those subtle flavors that you have in your wine. So let's try. But the wine stays very much itself.
Yeah, it's a cheap son of a bitch.
And it's really complimenting the fluke.
Yeah, see, because fluke rhymes with fruit, which also rhymes with hooch. And this wine tastes like fruity hooch.
I strongly believe this wine could go also with oysters and lemon juice. Anything with a very strong level of acidity. This is another success and another great wine pairing.
Yeah, it just takes a Madville tonight, chef. Tomorrow's gonna suck. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. And I got to tell you, this whole war of words over that word, foodie, it's not dying down. It's only heating up. People will not let it go. They hate the word. They hate the people associated with the word. And now, listen, I was putting off addressing this, but it is something I've been talking about with some people close to me for a while now. And I was going to get it out on the table sooner or later because, and listen, I'll admit this. I had reservations when I named the show whether or not to use the word foodie in the title, but it stuck. And I'm going up, it'll be 4 years next month. Gourmet's Diary of a Foodie was still running strong, and it seemed to best capture the spirit of what I was trying to relay in my show. But there are some royal pains in the ass out there who give the word foodie a bad reputation. They're pompous, overly preachy, just really hateable. They pray to the altar of Bourdain and Alice Waters, even though Bourdain himself has made a career out of taking low shots at foodies. And don't get me wrong, I like Bourdain. I've always liked Bourdain. Bourdain has been a very big inspiration for my show. But this doesn't change who I am. Anyone's perception of a foodie does not change me. It does not matter to me what anyone thinks of the word, what they think of my opinions on food issues, or how holier than thou they might think that I am. That's not me. It isn't. And anybody who knows me knows that. Short of changing the name of my show, perhaps this is me showing you what an anti-foodie is. And by anti-foodie, I mean the person who just enjoys food, beer, wine, cooking, talking to farmers, becoming one with the food that he puts on his table every night, not the photo-snapping dork at restaurants, you know, with his nose up a celebrity chef's ass, holding on to Bourdain's every word as if it was the gospel. You know, in time, maybe we'll move on to something else food-related, or maybe something else entirely, and we'll put the title foodie to bed. But that'll be out of necessity. But this isn't it. You know, for those of you out there who don't like the word foodie, tough shit. That's the name of my show. I'm sorry for hurting your sensibilities. But, you know, I've got a show to do, and this just happens to be the title of it. You know, we're going to do more cooking now, and we're going to try to be more guy-focused. But for the most part, I'm still going to talk about issues. I'm still going to talk about cooking. I'm still going to talk about food. I'm still going to share my experiences. And if you don't like it, you can certainly stop listening. It's not a problem. We are trying something new that we're going to be doing throughout the spring and summer. I was contacted in January by this company called Bordeaux Superior. They distribute French Bordeaux wines throughout the United States. And they asked if I would be interested in reviewing some Bordeaux wines for the show. And I said, yeah, because I do enjoy wine. It's time for me to start talking about these wines. I've been sitting on them for long enough. So throughout the spring and the summer, we're going to be tasting the wines that they sent. Now, I know you all have me pinned as a beer guy, and I am a beer guy for the most part, but I do enjoy wine, and I've never really brought it up on the show because we've always kind of stayed beer-centric here. But, you know, given the choice, most times when I'm out, if someone's offering a glass of sparkling wine or champagne, I'll take it. Over beer, I'll take it. Beer definitely has its place, but I'm a sucker for champagne and sparkling wine because it's fizzy like beer, it's refreshing, it tastes great, and it's something I can sip for a while. So I do like that. These wines that we're going to be sampling this year are all typical examples of what Bordeaux AOC wines have to offer. If you don't really know what Bordeaux is the largest wine-producing region of France. It takes its name from an important city and a port, and it accounts for one quarter of all of the wine produced in all appellations within France. If you look at France, think about a quarter of France is just Bordeaux. That is huge. And France makes a lot of wine. This region produces a wide range of styles and qualities of wine, from ordinary Bordeaux AOC wines to Grand Cru classes. They're both red and white wines are produced there, but the reds pretty much dominate, as you're going to learn about wine. When you're speaking of wine, reds tend to dominate the conversation. The red wines from the area are usually produced from Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, and Petit Verdot varieties. And white wines are produced from Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, and Muscadel grapes. Now, the wines from Bordeaux Superior offer a way for you to explore the appellations, the blends, and the color. That's the ABCs of Bordeaux. Remember that. Appellation, blend, and color. Because it's always those are always a part of a Bordeaux wine. At reasonable prices. Now, you don't have to spend a lot of money to enjoy good wine. You know, you really don't. It's not how much you're spending that determines how great the wine is that you're drinking. And that's important to remember. Because you can drink a great wine for $20 or under. And this is a great example of that. The difference between a $20 bottle and a $40 bottle to somebody who doesn't know an absolute lot about wine, you're not going to taste that difference. You're wasting $20. Somebody who knows a shitload about wine can probably tell you some nuances and why they like it. But a lot of wines that I've tasted that I've really enjoyed have been around $20 or under. And the great thing about all these wines from Bordeaux Superior is that they retail for under $20, all of them. And they still offer the classic character that has made Bordeaux one of the most well-known and well-respected wine regions in the world. California is great. And I think a lot of what, you know, California winemakers are doing is because of the precedent that was set by winemakers in Bordeaux. If you want more information about the wines that we're going to be enjoying this year, you can visit planet-bordeaux.com. Go to mylifeasafoodie.com. I'll put links to everything. The first wine that I'm enjoying on today's show is Chateau Pinin Bordeaux Rosé. It's 2009. When people say rosé, the first thing people assume is white Zinfandel. And they shouldn't, because that's an abomination. You know, that's a crime what they've done with white Zinfandel. It's like Kool-Aid. It's literally just a step above Four Loko. Okay? It really is. It's pathetic. I saw a picture not too long ago with some street fair in New York. And they were serving white Zinfandel in these clear plastic cups with straws in them. It looked like Kool-Aid. Strong Kool-Aid. And the thing is, they ran a stat recently. And they found that white Zinfandel accounted for 10% of all wines sold by volume, making it the third most popular varietal in the United States. It outsold red Zinfandel 6-1. That's a crime. Now, rosés are generally made, and this goes for all rosés, generally made by leaving the grape skins in contact with the grape juice for about 2 to 3 days instead of the usual 14 days to make a red wine. They take some tannins, from the grape skin contact and the good acidity of a white wine. So it makes rosé very versatile, makes it very food friendly. And rosés can be sweet or they can be bone dry. It depends on how long they leave that skin on. The expression color does not lie, have you ever heard that with wine? That definitely applies with rosés. If you've got a lighter colored rosé, light and pink, that's a light style rosé. So you'll have a lighter bodied wine. Darker would mean darker, more bold. This wine, the Chateau Pinot Bordeaux Rosé, is 85% Cabernet Sauvignon and 15% Merlot. It's fresh, it's fruit forward, yet kind of rich and elegant. Listen, I am not going to sit here and tell you all the nuances of this wine, because I can't. I am not that good. I'm not a wine guy, I'm not a wine expert, but I do know what I like, and I can pick out flavors from anything. And in this one, I get strawberries and raspberries. And I'm going to tell you a story. If you think I'm crazy, I've been wine tasting for years and years. I mean, I've been drinking wine since I was in college. But this was a great story. We went to Temecula, wine tasting with a friend, another couple, Katrina and I. And this was a long time ago. We go to this winery, and they had some really interesting wines. And this one wine that they were in the process of producing was a Fumé Blanc. The guy says, we just pressed the grapes. Would you like to taste them? And I said, yeah. So they brought out this pitcher of grape juice, and the guy pours us a little sample. He goes, taste this and tell me what fruit you taste. And I tasted it, and I picked up apples. And he goes, exactly. And I thought to myself, how the hell can a grape taste like an apple? It does. And that's the beautiful thing about wine. And that's the thing about wine. It's just really weird that, you know, depending on the year, you can make a bad one or you can make one that's better than the other. Well, we can't say that with beer. I think it was Sean Paxton said this. Beer doesn't have that luxury. You know, you can't say, this wine, why does the beer suck? He goes, oh, it was a bad year for the barley. No, it's consistent. It has to be consistent. You know, you can make these vintage ales, you know, or the vertical epic and stuff like that and age them. And they might taste different, you know, further down the road. But every year, unless you're changing the recipe, it should taste the same. Well, that's not true with wine because they can't do it. You know, a lot of it has to do with how much sun they got, how much rain they got, how cold it got at night. All those things, they change everything. So these guys are geniuses. And, I heard some stories that Peter Huey was talking about his brother who owns a winery. And some of the things that they do. And I just think to myself, I go, that is a very scientific job. I mean, you think beer is one thing, but making wine or mixing wine, that takes that's a master's touch. Anyway, back to this wine, 13% alcohol. So be careful, respect it. Have maybe one or two glasses, call it a night. And the best part, $13. It retails for $13. Chateau Pinot wines are primarily available in New York and New Jersey. So if you live on the East Coast, Get yourself some, and if you have a friend on the East Coast, have them send some to you. I know it's illegal, but we're all pirates. The estate, I'll talk about the estate, actually started in 1854, but they really didn't start getting serious about making wine until 1964. They grew fruit on half the place, on the land that they had. They grew fruit on one side, and then they grew some vines. Well, in 1982, the guy decides, you know what, screw this, let's just grow grapes. So they tore out all the parts of the farm that weren't growing grapes, and they planted all these vines, and now they produce enough wine to produce 270,000 bottles of wine a year. Let's talk about terroir, because I started to talk about this. Terroir is actually, it describes the ground, the soil, and the conditions that the vines grow in. Some grapevines, like to be abused. In a way, a lot of these robust grapevines are like being a Dodger fan. You just like the abuse. You want to be lied to. You want to be mistreated. You want to be left out in the sun. You don't need a lot of water. You know, you just like to be angry and sulking. Pinot Noir likes to be pampered. Say, Pinot Noir would be like a Yankee fan. You expect to win. You expect things to go your way. And if they don't, man, you're pissed. You don't produce. Fuck it. That's the difference. If I can make a difference. So, terroir, I think I'm maybe mispronouncing that because my French really sucks. Is really about the ground. And the ground that they have, it's localized gravel soils. It's got a limestone plateau on one side and a marshland on the left bank of a river on the other. And the ground is made up of red sand and round pebbles, which came from, you know, years and years ago from that river that used to run through there. It just left all these pebbles. And they're shaped by the river. The depth of the soil is anywhere from 5 to 8 meters, and only these vines can grow on really poor, hot soil. And you think about the character of these grapes. It comes from how they're treated. And it's a lot like a tomato. If you've ever planted tomato plants, you know, tomato plants kind of like to be abused too. They like to be out in the sun against a hot wall. They don't want a lot of water. They really want to work hard. You know, if you've got a tomato plant and you keep it well shaded and you water it all the time, it might produce some tomatoes, but they're not going to be really good. Now, if you've got a tomato plant that's left out in the sun, you water it maybe once or twice a week, you know, you leave it out and it's hot and it looks like hell, well, it works very hard to get water. It's got to dig further to get it, and when it does get it and distribute it back, it's got a lot more character. So those tomatoes are going to be incredible. It's like, you know, going to war. Talk to a war veteran. The stories and the character in these people, it's amazing because they've been through hell. And I think sometimes you've got to be through hell in order to build character. If you've been pampered, you're not going to have a lot of character. You're just going to be fruity. You're going to be pleasant, but you're going to be fruity. I am making some comparisons here, right? I'll tell you something, and I'm not kidding you. I am no Sue Sterling, okay? If you really want to hear someone go off on wine, you want to go to thenakedwineshow.com or watch Grape Notes on Food Network Canada. Sue has it wired. I do not. I recommend goat cheese with this rosé. All right, but it's good also with some fish. We were going to make fish in the show, but something else trumped it. As I said, rosés vary in color. They're either light pink or deeper pink. The lighter colored rosés will be softer, and they'll pair best with delicate dishes like salads, cheese, any kind of a fish dish. If you've got a darker, bolder style, you pair it with grilled meats and spicy dishes. And forget all the myths, okay? Like white wine is the only thing you should have with fish. Bullshit. You can have whatever wine you feel would complement the dish, while the dish elevates the wine. That's what you always need to remember, and that goes with everything, okay? So just keep that in mind. For more information about the winery, ChateauPinion.com or planet-bordeaux.com. Again, I'll leave links for everything on mylifeasafoodie.com. So I celebrated my birthday recently, and like last year, it turned out to be a very food-centric day. And listen, thanks to all you guys, everyone who commented on Facebook, that was overwhelming. I mean, I love it. I do. I love Facebook on birthdays. You ever notice that? Someone has a birthday on Facebook? Check it out. Everyone's saying happy birthday. People love, and I love it, to read happy birthday from everybody. You've got 100 people saying happy birthday in one day. It's like the year we went to Disneyland for Katrina's birthday, because it was that year they're running that promotion. You can go to Disneyland on your birthday for free. And she wore this tag, "Hi, my name is Katrina. Today's my birthday." Everybody who worked in that park who saw that on her said, "Well, happy birthday, Katrina." And it got overwhelming for her, but it was fun. And I thought it was great. Anyway, this year on that day, Katrina took me to Los Angeles. And we met Peter and Joe at Lindy and Grundy, which is a butcher shop, brand new butcher shop, that sells local pastured and organic meats. Now listen, the stuff that they sell, somewhat pricey. It's choice meat, okay? It's a throwback to the past, though, like where Sam the Butcher from the Brady Bunch used to work. Except that Sam the Butcher wasn't cutting up heritage breed pigs or grass-fed cows or organic chickens. And when we got there, we're greeted by Peter and Joe, as well as the owners of the shop, Amelia and Erica, who opened it together. They're both so sweet and friendly and welcoming. They wished me happy birthday. I felt like I was in heaven, you know? I've had dreams about being in a meat shop like this. It was a lot like the first day I went to Cordy Brothers in Sacramento. That was like a dream to me. And it was just so nice. So anyway, they're wishing me happy birthday. They present me with this gift certificate that Joe and Peter had purchased for me as a gift. And it had, insert cash amount here. I'll tell you, it was generous. They give me this amount to spend any way I wanted on meat in their shop. So I'm thinking, oh, great. Well, they sell good meat. Maybe I'll buy a shoulder or I'll buy a couple of steaks. You know, I could have done that. But Amelia wants to give us a tour of the place and a tour of the meat locker before we go shopping. So we put on these hairnets, and believe me, listen, you do not want to see me in a hairnet. I look so stupid. I mean, I look stupid anyway, but with a hairnet, it's even worse. I look like a big bass in a net. So anyway, we put these things on, and we walk into the meat locker. Hanging in this small room, this cold room, are whole, butchered Berkshire, Duroc, and Coon Cooney pigs. Are they Cooney Cooney? Yeah, Cooney Cooney pigs. Oh, ferocious looking. There's a half side of a cow and some split pigs from another farm. These are all locally grown within 150 miles of their shop. They're free-range, heritage breed piggies. They're not your factory commercial pigs. They were cared for, raised, and slaughtered with the utmost attention. She has this big Hobart grinder in there for sausages, because you got to keep that grinder cold. You remember the sausage episode? We talked about that. And she had these huge rib sections of beef on racks that were aging. They do all their own aging there. And that's the thing. You walk in there, you say, I want a T-bone steak, or I want a ribeye steak, 1.5 inches thick. She'll take that whole thing, the whole rib roast, on her big belt saw, and she'll cut it for you to order. It's just, damn, just amazing. So she scoots one of these cooney-coonies over, which I got to tell you, one of the most ferocious-looking pigs. It's got these big tusks coming out of its mouth, just hardcore, like a razorback. As she pushes them over, on this rack behind them are Berkshire pig heads, smiling, as usual, you know. Berkshire pigs are just happy pigs. Even in death, they're happy. They're just happy to be around. So anyway, I'm in heaven. You know, I never thought I'd be standing in a meat locker with about $8,000 worth of Berkshire and Durox hanging there, just chilling, you know. We get out of the locker, and she says to me, I hear that you're into offal. And I turn and I said, yeah, I am. Do you have offal from these animals? Well, it turns out, yeah, of course they do. They sell everything. I mean, they are nose to tail in this place. They sell everything. They waste nothing. No waste. Even the scraps are reused to this farm for another reason I'm not going to talk about. It's 100% natural, eco-friendly, very smart. So I'm thinking to myself, whatever types of organ meats they have, I'll definitely be interested in it because I don't get a lot of stuff. The run-of-the-mill stuff, okay? A tongue, maybe, if you're lucky. Feet, you might find pig ears if you're lucky. You know, I'll find that kind of stuff in the Asian store, but nothing great, not really good quality items. But whatever they had, I thought I would definitely look at. I ended up with things I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, let alone walk out the door with. Berkshire pork jowls, which I'll make guanciale with, which is a dried cured type of pancetta, kind of like bacon and pancetta. I got sweetbreads, pork cheeks, lamb hearts, a huge ass beef tongue. I mean, this thing is monster. A mix of ground beef and their house cured bacon. They make their own bacon and sausages there. They've got a smoker in the back. She says this mix, this ground beef, bacon mix, makes the tastiest grinder in the world. I got Berkshire pork fat and casings for sausage. Heaven. And this is the greatest gift, this place. Lindy and Grundy, 801 North Fairfax Avenue in Los Angeles. You can check out the website, lindyandgrundy.com. Again, I'll put a link on the website, My Life as a Foodie. You don't have to go there now. And you can check it out. They're a sustainable butcher shop. All right, they practice true nose-to-tail butchering. It allows them to utilize the entire animal, so they produce very little waste. As I said, they're small, and the farms they buy from are small. No antibiotics, no hormones, nothing in their animals. And the grass that they eat is never treated with pesticides or herbicides. They're committed to only sourcing meats from small family farms within 150 miles of their shop. Their belief is that by eating food that's locally grown, it allows for 100% traceability and allows them to support local economies and communities. And now this is the kind of stuff, again, that makes the anti-foodies hate us. And I just don't see anything wrong with living this way. If you can afford it, do it. And we're happy about it. We want to share this information. Because I'll tell you what, you do, and then people say, I didn't even know that was possible. I didn't even know that was available. Well, it's not as much as it used to be. And it should. And it's a shame it's so damned expensive. But it is expensive. Because it's, you know, it costs more to raise them this way. But here's the thing. How often do you eat meat? Oh, how often do you really need to eat meat? I mean, you can eat 3 cheap pork chops or 1 really good one. That's a good way to look at it. But this is just a prelude to what came next. Up the street for dinner. Katrina takes me to Animal, a restaurant I've been wanting to eat at ever since I met Joe. It's owned and operated by chefs John Shook and Vinny Dottolo. The food is punk rock and classical music all at the same time. That's the best way I can describe this. It's been open only 3 years, but they've been named Food & Wine's Best New Chefs of 2009. They've had 2 James Beard nominations and 1 Wine List of the Year from GQ Magazine. I mean, the place, it's amazing. The food is almost too hard to describe, really. Rustic and decadent comfort food. That's the best I can do. I'll tell you what it reminded me of a lot was Pierre de Cachon. in Montreal. Bourdain went to this place on no reservations when he visited Quebec. And Martin Picard, the owner chef there, tried to kill him. Seriously. He told the wait staff, they were, you know, doing the subtitles because he speaks in French. He said, feed him till he's dead. They captioned it on screen. He said, feed him and feed him and feed him. And when he dies, stop. They brought out foie gras, duck in a can, cassoulet, poutine, which I forgot he had even ordered until I ordered it, and a shit ton of wine. Now, Bourdain can eat, okay, and Picard knew he could eat, so he took it as a challenge to break him, which he did.
Get ready, friends, for the most rich, outrageously over-the-top, Titanic-sized opus dedicated to all things fatty, porky, and delicious at the defiantly transgressive Haute Pied Cochon, where I finally and indisputably meet my match.
This is an ode to just pure goodness and excess.
It's my Waterloo of gluttony, a meal unlike any I've ever had. When I find out finally and definitively whether you can indeed have too much of a good thing.
I don't know, if the Manson family were all like really great cooks, there's that same level of devotion. I'm right?
Pretty much.
So we get there, and everything's seasonal, right? So not the things that are on the menu today may not be on there next week. So everything was just kind of, there was no way of knowing what was going to be on the menu until we got there. We ordered a hamachi tostada, foie gras terrine with pickled Asian pear, bone marrow with chimichurri and garlic toast, poutine, and for dessert, a dark chocolate crunchy bar with candied bacon. The food at Animal is rich, stick-to-your-ribs food. It's served a lot like tapas, where each dish is brought out to the table to be the star of the plate, star of the table. Generally, you share these things with the table, so everybody picks off of it, and then you bring on the next plate. And they're making things at Animal that most home cooks just couldn't pull off. Although, I'd be dying to try, you know? Our waiter took our order, right? All the things I said we ordered. He decided how we should have it, as in what order we should have it. And I'm so glad he did this for us, because it was perfect. And let me say something about the staff. Fantastic. Everybody was friendly. It was not pretentious at all. It's not what you think, okay? It is just, it's very LA, but very laid back. The hamachi tostada came first, and it was better than I anticipated that it would be. It was a crispy corn tortilla with a whole piece of hamachi on it, about a half an inch thick, which had been cooked ceviche style with lime juice. And then on top of that, they had a huge amount of coleslaw that had so many bright flavors, I couldn't pick them all out. I tasted fish sauce, that salty Vietnamese genius ingredient, makes everything better. Sliced serrano peppers. I'm a whore for slaw, okay? So I could have eaten three of these things and been done with the evening, but we had a lot more to eat. So around this time, Emilia, who's just close shop at Lindy and Grundy, comes by and hand delivers my offal in a styrofoam cooler that Peter and Joe had brought with ice and ice packs in it. We were running late for our reservation. She says, I'll bring it to you. She hugs me, says happy birthday again. What an experience, you know. Maybe the only time I'll be eating at a restaurant and a butcher shop drops off my meat order. That was awesome. And the staff just rolls with it. By the way, did I tell you this place was not pretentious? I mean, everybody had tattoos, young, hot, and they played rap music over the sound system. I mean, you might be paying $15, $18 for a plate of food, but that doesn't mean you have to be a stuffy prick about it. And that's what I love about this place. In a way, in a lot of ways, it reminded me a lot of Ludo Bites. And what I loved about Ludo Bites, and what I love about Ludo Bites, a second dish comes, foie gras. It's a terrine of foie gras with pickled Asian pear and buttered toast. Again, foie is so mild, both in texture and in flavor, that anybody who thinks, oh, liver, you know, it doesn't, it's not a bad thing. You'll get through it, believe me, and you'll love it. Chicken liver. That's what people think it tastes like. You know, that's strong and deep, sometimes even dirty. This doesn't taste that way. It's pure fatty goodness. It's butter. And I know this isn't the best thing in the world for you to eat, and my doctor's going to have a field day with my ass. She takes my blood. She's going to kill me. It was worth it. You know, sometimes you just got to fat it up. We don't do it that often. But this was spectacular. So we're so careful about how much we're eating, we had to get more bread brought to our table. We were kind of savoring it. And that pickled Asian pear reminded me a lot of those pickled grapes that Dusky Estes made for Bovolo. Tasted like the holidays. So we noticed that Michael Vitaggio was there with Cole Dickinson, who's the chef de cuisine at Inc. Vitaggio's restaurant's opening here in Los Angeles pretty soon. John Shook comes out of the kitchen, sits down with them. He stays the rest of the night. Sits down and eats, drinks with them. It's cool to see chefs who get along. talk shop over a glass of wine. Just, you know, it's nice. So the bone marrow with chimichurri comes next. You know, we had it at Ad Hoc last year, total meat butter. The chimichurri was a really good idea. They had garlic toast with it. Chimichurri is like a pesto that's made from chopped parsley, minced garlic, olive oil, red vinegar, and red pepper flakes. In Argentina, they use that as a sauce for meats when, you know, they eat a lot of meat, so they put the sauce on the meat. It's kind of like their salad, I guess. But I thought this was a smart move with the bone marrow. And it's funny, too. I had not eaten bone marrow one time in my life, and in less than a year, I've had it twice in restaurants. I've made it twice at home, like becoming a staple. And again, man, my doctor's, she's going to kick my ass. Anyway, plate four comes, and thank God this was last, because I ended up taking home, you know, in a little carton. I had to take it to go. I couldn't even manage to eat a quarter of what was on the plate. They're crispy frites, French fries, topped with fresh cheese curds and braised oxtail in a sauce so rich, I swear to you, this had to be 100% demi-glace, because it was so rich, there was no possible way I could have eaten this entire plate by myself at all and finished anything else they served us. This was obscene. This dish is just really kind of over the top in a good way. It's the ultimate in richness. And I should add here that Animal buys only locally grown seasonal produce, and the proteins that they use are from farms that they know, farms that they have toured, and farms they certainly can trust. They're exactly the perfect topper to any visit to Lindy and Grundy. Lindy and Grundy chops it and sells it. Animal cooks it and serves it. Fairfax, my new favorite street in Los Angeles. So we wanted that bacon chocolate crunch bar for dessert so bad, and we'd have to pass on it if we finished that poutine. So we ordered it, and we had very little appetite left, but we finished it. It's amazing. Dark chocolate is so rich, creamy, and you don't really want to eat more than a few forkfuls, so it was kind of perfect. They make it in layers, and then they chop it. It's in the bottom layer is kind of made of like a Nutella. And then on the second layer, there's a creamy mousse that's made with peanuts. And then the top layer is praline that they kiss with a little flame to burn it down a little. Then they coat that with a ganache and then a healthy layer of this crispy bacon on top. Now, I read that they render all of the fat out of that bacon. So there's no fat in it, so it doesn't add any richness to it, so it's super crunchy. AnimalRestaurant.com. Bring your appetite. I swear to God. Tons of great wines. They serve Racer 5 IPA. I had that. Thank you very much. I do know that everything is seasonal, so some of the things that we had may or may not be on the menu when you go. They do some really good things there, and I'd like to come back in a couple months and see what's there, because I know it changes constantly. Hey, listen, there's this new show on HBO. It's called Treme. Is it Treme or Trem? It's the name of the neighborhood in the city of New Orleans. Trem? It begins 3 months after Hurricane Katrina, where the residents of New Orleans, including musicians, chefs, and just, you know, people from New Orleans, try to rebuild their lives, try to rebuild their homes, and their culture, of course, after the hurricane hit in 2005. This was from a couple weeks ago. In this episode, this was a scene in the kitchen where one of the chefs brings that infamous GQ article that Alan Richman wrote in 2006 about New Orleans. This is the article that, you know, Bourdain came out and said that Alan Richman really, he hit below the belt. That's when Alan Richman turned around and wrote that horrible piece about Leal, and that's what started the whole thing. And then Bourdain called him the C word. Listen to this.
Hey, you were in New Orleans, right?
New Orleans, yeah.
Right, well, you're going to read this and go batshit. This guy leveled your town. He's ripping the chefs, the food, everything.
Alan Richman? He wrecked us?
He's like the dean of food writing. Fucker's got like 6 million beard awards.
Holy shit. I can't believe it. He's not just ripping the food. Check it out. New Orleans was always a three-day stubble of a city. I'm not certain the cuisine was ever as good as its reputation, in part because the people who consumed, evaluated, and admired it likely weren't sober enough at the time of ingestion to know what they were eating.
Whoa.
Fuck.
Supposedly, creoles can be found in and around New Orleans. I have never met one and suspect they are fairy folk, like leprechauns.
That's funny shit.
It's kind of harsh.
Richmond is a serious guy. That's going to get a lot of play.
Oh, right. Now he goes on to trash Susan Spicer. And Donald Link? Donald Link is a fucking hero. Donald Link was like one of the first guys back, standing there serving free food in the street. I mean, holy shit. Town's just barely on its feet, and this son of a bitch has got to come down and reevaluate whether we were ever any good. Make fucking batter as entree jokes. Yeah, we heard him.
Guy's got a point about the cooking down there. I mean, last time I was in New Orleans, it was like...
Fine, fine. He doesn't like the food. He thinks it's heavy or he thinks it's shit. I don't care. But for fuck's sake, it's a service economy. They're fucking hurting. He's got to write this now. Tell people to stay away from New Orleans. Don't come down. Don't spend your money in restaurants. I'm not going to
help you. Hey, listen, we were talking about that wine being available in New Jersey. In Red Bank, New Jersey, John Bon Jovi's Soul Kitchen opened. It's an interesting thing here he's got going. He opened this restaurant where you pay what you can afford, and volunteers basically help run the restaurant. And it's founded on the principle that a healthy meal feeds your soul, which is why they call it Soul Kitchen. Diners can pick any item on the menu and pay what they're able to pay. Patrons who don't have money can volunteer an hour of their time in the kitchen to cover the cost of the meal. And anybody who can afford to give a little more can pay it forward, you know, pay a little more than $10, which is kind of a recommended donation. So you don't really have to pay, but you can, and then you can also, you know, work in the kitchen. He wants the place to be, you know, a place for community and conversation. He has volunteer staff that serve the diners, and the patrons are encouraged to meet and greet new friends and just kind of provide some community. Listen to this.
When a community comes together, hope fills the room. Hope can feed the soul. Soul Kitchen is a community restaurant, a warm, welcoming place. On Sundays, our volunteers set the table for you. When you dine here, you help feed the hungry in your own community, neighbors, seniors, and families in need. Instead of prices on our menu, you pay what you can, or you can pay it forward. No one is ever turned away. Fresh food with vegetables grown here in the Garden State, all prepared daily by our merry band of helpers and chefs.
You're getting good food and real food and food that you make with love and food that you make with nutrition instead of, you know, fast food, processed, junk food.
I serve the food the way I would want it to serve. Committed to what I do. I enjoy what I do. So I put the soul in this whole kitchen.
Pull up a chair and feel the warmth of good company, a little conversation, a moment to relax.
I came with some old friends and I made a new friend here. This is Dirk. Over here is Ricky and this is Obi.
In fact, his new friend is such that he's going to trade the old friend for the new friend.
At the end of the meal, you pay what you can afford, pay more than the suggested donation, and you help to feed someone else. Or you can work in our kitchen in exchange for a meal for yourself or your family.
I walk here. It's not too far from where I live. It takes about a half an hour. I think it's a very good place to come to, and I think the people are very friendly, and the food is very good, and they should come and enjoy themselves and socialize with people.
We are offering a situation to empower you to become involved in the food that you have received. This is what makes us a little bit different than existing soup kitchen.
That's a beautiful thing about it. You know, everyone gets to come out and mingle and mix together and get a nice meal and it's giving back to the community also.
Come join us on Sundays. Together, we can help end hunger in our communities. Soul Kitchen. All are welcome at our table.
I got to tell you, man, I watched that video. I had some tears in my eyes. It's just great to see people who care this much about other people and just kind of help feed the hungry, especially in community. And, you know, we've hit tough times here. And then find a way to help them and then help them help themselves, too. I mean, say what you want about foodies, but I know a lot of food bloggers who donate money, time, they raise tons of money for hunger drives, Share Our Strength, Eat My Blog. They work hard for that stuff. You know, hunger is a food issue too, and that's a lot of what we're about. One other thing I want to hit on, then I'll let you guys go. And this was last week it broke, or maybe the week before. I bag on Paula Deen quite a bit here on the show, and you know, I we have a lot of fun. I don't care for her cooking, her the meals that she makes. I think you may as well just go out to dinner or go eat some fast food if you're going to cook this way. But I don't wish her harm. I don't wish her any, you know, ill will. Well, it broke last week that she's been suffering from type 2 diabetes for several years due to her diet. Now, who knows if it's her diet or if it's in her genes, but, and mind you, this report came from the National Enquirer, so, but her TV kind of relies on the fact that, you know, she cooks with sugar, butter, and fat. And now they're saying, well, these are the things that lead to this disease, which can kill you. You know, like I said, it's the Enquirer who released the story, but no one came out and defended it. No one disputed this story, so, well, it turns out that her friends kept the secret from her fans. Well, so did she. I mean, I don't say that her friends did it. It was her. You know, she got diagnosed with diabetes several years ago. And you remember, I said she lost a lot of weight. I mean, she looks a lot better now than she did before. She got a personal trainer. Remember she came out on stage in that video? Oh, God, my britches. Her britches fell down. My britches.
Hey, y'all.
You remember that? So she's said to be under doctor's orders to steer clear of the foods, obviously. And a family friend of Dean's told the Enquirer when Paula was diagnosed with diabetes, I think she was worried that if her secret got out, it would make her look like a hypocrite. Well, no shit. I mean, I think if the Smithfield Farms thing didn't stick, do you think this would? Who knows? People are stupid. The people who follow her are stupid. They buy into it. Look at her. Google her right now. Look at her picture. Look at that face with the makeup and the fake hair and the eyelashes and the big fake smile. If you're smiling that big, you're hiding something. She's either hiding the fact that she's a hypocrite or they actually just made a multi-million-dollar deal for cooking shit and for teaching people how to cook shit. Now, it wouldn't be a problem if she was just teaching people how to cook shit, but I know a lot of women who actually cook that shit and feed it to their kids. Stupid. If you're going to cook that way, you may as well just buy McDonald's. Seriously, there's a better way to cook. Just cook natural. That freaking burger with the Krispy Kreme donut as a bun. It's like she's the poster child for diabetes, but she's been the poster child for thisiswhyyourefat.com. Come out and say something. She was afraid it was going to make her look like a hypocrite. No shit. Wow. And people are so stupid, they'll just disregard this story. Ah, it was the Enquirer. Nah, but you hens believed all the other bullshit in the Enquirer, but not Paula. Because those are the people. It's funny. That's like the irony in this whole thing. Is that the same people who read the Enquirer are people who basically follow Paula Deen. But they won't believe this story. Now you got to get some stories wrong. Okay. Anyway, whew, that was snarky. That's all I have. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to HBO for the audio. Hey, you can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Go to mylifeisthefoodie.com. There are links there. You can do all this stuff. Check our website for links to everything today. And until next time, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. Cheers. For a
the first time.